Okay. All right. So, again, we come back to the problem. He's learning into Moshe Shemra. But there's a problem there, too. What did we say? The problem is that if we're going to say, as a result of Gezeirah Shavah, that A and B are identical, right, we find too many factors that indicate that they're not identical. So how can you bring a generalization out of this?
Right. Well, let's say the first instance, the one that was not Moshe Shemra, but the one that was posed against him.
Well, you mean the first thing about
The accusation, yeah, that
the original accusation.
Zomamin. What was that? I don't remember.
The Zomamin. All right. The first part of the Mishnah says, that we testify against so-and-so that he owes so-and-so 200 zuz. Okay? So, since they were Adam Zomamin, in other words, they were false witnesses, so therefore, according to Rabbi Meir, they should get both makas, right? Malkos, if you want to use the term that they use over here, right? So they should get malkos, because of the violation of giving false testimony, right?
Right.
And at the same time, they owe the guy the money that, they would have cost him, right?
Right.
So it would be Lokan and Mishalman. Chachamim come along, and they disagree with Rabbi Meir.
The argument is about a double penalty.
Right.
No,
the Chachamim come along, and they say, look, if the guy pays the money, then in that particular case, he doesn't get malchus, because he can only from one Risha. And what is the Risha? The Risha in this case is the fact that he was an Eid Zomim. So as an Eid Zomim, give back what you propose to do to the other guy. But to get malchus in addition, how come to say no? They don't get it. So again, why does Rabbi Meir say Lokim Mishalman? Of course, the original reason is because he said that there are two different prohibitions that are involved. You know, Lomin Hashem, as he said before, that in reality the Torah has two different types of prohibitions. One is that you're not allowed, of course, to give false testimony, and the other one is, the fact that if a person is convicted as being a Russian in this case, then, what is the penalty? Penalty is that he gets malchus, you see. So, that being the case, he says, you can give him two penalties. But the Chachamim come back, with the answer that only Mishum Risha Achas at the Bechayva, right? That you can only condemn him to punishment for one, but not to punishment for both of these things. Okay? So now they're trying to establish in general the idea of Rabbi Meir's reasoning. So along came Ula and said, first of all, that Rabbi Meir was basing it on comparing the Moshe Shemra, where in the Torah itself, the implication is that you have to both penalize him by giving him malchus, that's the Yisru also, right? And the other one is the Onshu also Meir Kesel, that, he also has to pay money. But, again, are we to therefore infer that as a rule, we can make a generalization and say that this is a knas, for example, right? And therefore, wherever you violate a knas, you should get malchus. No, you can't do that either, right? And then you see, they try to bring in another matter, namely, can you say that maybe it's the element that we should examine of lav handitak la'ase, right? In other words, a violation of a negative commandment where, you have some affirmative commandment that sort of cancels it out, okay? And therefore, if it's a lav, nitak la'ase, then in that particular case, you should not get any malchus for that, right?
Pay the money.
But there is a difference of opinion about that. There's one authority who says, that he should. At least it seems to be the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda that he should get malchus, as against Rabbi Akiva. So now they're examining another angle, the same problem. Ula says that Rabbi Meir is still trying to base it upon Gezeirah Shel Motzi Shemra, right? And maybe it's the aspect of Lav She'ein Bo Maaseh, you know, where the Chachamim say Ein Lo Ken Alav, right? Whereas in the case of you know, Rabbi Yehuda, maybe we would say that Lav She'ein Bo Maaseh Lo Ken Alav, even though there's no actual act that you're doing, nevertheless, for violation of a prohibition of the Torah, you should get malchus. Okay, so they're not happy with that either. Why? Because again, that means it would be generalization. So now they bring a different aspect. It says, "Ma la motzi shemra." The motzi shemra shekain lokin mishalim, right? And so therefore we should justify the fact that in the case of the Yedim Zomimim, they too should be Lokin Umishalim, right? Lokin Umishalim.
Right.
So Elo Amar Reish Lakish, so Reish Lakish no, disagrees with that.
Excuse me.
Yes.
What I don't understand is that trying to make a match between the accusation of someone that owed a debt but didn't pay it,
yeah,
and a bride that was to be a virgin but was not.
Yeah.
Does anyone speak to this issue that it doesn't match exactly? You started with it.
Okay. The
you
question is.
That was
all right.
That
this is a very good observation. But as I say, really what they're interested in is to try to take and see can you generalize from one to the other? Or are there factors that stick out like a sore thumb? So that you cannot really draw the comparison between one and the other.
Well, do they? I mean,
yeah.
Is this discussion...
Yeah, this is what the discussion is really aiming at.
Okay.
Right. So now they try something else. Amar Reish Lakish, right? Gomar Miyedim Zomimim. He says that, you know, Rabbi Meir, he figured it out from the case of Edom Zomim itself. Ma Edom Zomimim. Take a look. Edom Zomim is Lav She'ein Bo Maaseh, right? Because all that they're doing is to say something. They didn't do any action. And nevertheless, the Torah says, Lokin Olav, right? That they have to get Malkus. Yeah? So, Av Kol Lav She'ein Bo Maaseh, Lokin Olav. Then in that case, any Lav which involves, you know, which does not involve any physical action, nevertheless, the person gets malchus, right? Okay. As I said, the Chachamim, of course, disagree completely with this. I mean, they say that there is no such thing. But, you know, we're still trying to understand what makes Rabbi Meir's opinion tick in this particular case. If this is what he's doing, if he's drawing, you know, from the Motzi Shemra and trying to make a comparison with the Edom Zomimim, then on what basis does he do it? Okay? So, they came. They come again and they say, wait a minute, there's another thing that's a little bit different, right? Mal Edom Zomimim, in the case of Edom Zomimim, says, Shekain Ein Tzrichim Hasra, you know, that normally for a person to receive either capital punishment or to receive Malkos, which after all is considered like a form of capital punishment, although not as severe, you understand? Yeah, it's corporal punishment, okay? It's not something that you come into the court in because you have a monetary dispute with somebody else. That's not involved in it, okay? But you have, you know, different degrees of punishment. The Rambam enumerates several of them. I'll just mention, you know, these three. One of them is, you know, capital punishment, which we understand. Malkos, obviously, is a degree of lesser severity. And then, in between, if you wish, according to the Rambam, you have what we would call Miso B'dei Shemayim and Kores. Miso B'dei Shemayim means that you die at an early age because you have violated something that the Torah says that you should not do. It's you know, it's a bad thing, right? Mm-hmm. And Kores is that, you know, you have violated a law where in the Torah specifically it says that v'nichrusu ha'nefesh ha'hi or v'nichrusu ha'nefoshes ha'osas, okay? In other words, the soul that has committed this will be cut off. Okay? So these, the Rambam actually puts in between, because he figures that, you know, if it's heavenly punishment, as in the case of, you know, of Kores and Misa B'dei Shemayim, then in that case, that should be considered even more severe than the fact that, you know, a court down below over here is giving somebody malchus, you see. But nevertheless, in the case, whether it's corporal punishment or whether it's malchus, and even for the others that I mentioned, the Torah has what is called an ashora. What do I mean by ashora? Ashora means literally warning. A warning is that you say that this is an avera, right? It's a sin. And then afterwards, a subsequent verse will come along and indicate what the punishment would be for the sin. But the idea is that you're not allowed in general to punish somebody for a crime unless the Torah has already given warning that this is a crime to begin with. If we were to take, for example, the example of, let's say, of Edom Sodomim, okay? So, where in the Torah does it say that, you know, they're not allowed to give false witness? The answer is the Ten Commandments. We already have that.
Right.
So, you know, that can be considered like an ashora. And then the other one, you know, would be the actual penalty. And of course, let's say, if the Torah says, Lo tinoch, thou shalt not commit adultery. So then along comes in Sefer Vayikra, for example, a whole list of prohibited relationships, you know, which involve, let's say, adultery in one form or another.
True.
Okay? So the first one is Lo Tinoch. That is the Ashora. You're not allowed to commit adultery. And then along comes the whole list of the other things, you know, to tell you that these are violations and what the punishment can be. Yes.
I thought when he's talking about warning someone before capital punishment, it's not that it's in the Torah, but that you have to turn to someone and say, stop, don't kill him.
Okay, that's what they call hasra, right. We call that hasra, correct.
So I don't
that in order to convict a person of capital punishment, see, I'm talking about, first of all, about prohibitions in the text itself, okay? That a person is supposed to learn and know that it's wrong.
Okay,
this
so
is the Ashora, yeah. Okay?
No. Come on, this thou shalt not kill.
Right.
All right, so you already had that warning.
That's correct. But
an
actual ruling, when a person is seen that he's committing or about to commit a deed, you know, like murder or something like that, you have to, the witnesses have the moral obligation to tell this man, you know, this is prohibited by the Torah, and do you know that you will be receiving capital punishment if you violate this? And if he says, I don't give a damn, I'm still going to go ahead and do what I'm doing, then in that case he's liable to the penalty of capital punishment. But, you know, if no warning was given, then that's already a different ballgame. It doesn't mean that the guy is necessarily going to go free, because there may be another problem, and that is that maybe they'll consider that he's a menace to society, and so therefore he is put into what they call a kippah, not a yarmulke, but a small confining place where he he's not given luxury quarters or anything like that, and the idea being, you know, that he should receive a punishment that he'll realize that he did very bad.
Sounds
and
very
if he dies in the process or something like that, then, you know, that would be his deserved punishment. It's not an execution, it's punishment, but nevertheless, it is. You know, it's like tantamount to life imprisonment, but as I say, not with all the amenities that American life imprisonment has.
Now we're discussing the zoning of witnesses.
Yes.
So that means, does it mean then, that in a court case, the witness comes in, the judge has to adjure him, don't tell any lies because otherwise you'll be liable to...
All right, that's the problem.
I mean,
so here we learn a new idea, namely that Edom Zomimim do not need Hasra. They don't need it. Because what they're doing already has been told by the Torah, shall not bear false witness against the neighbor. They're aware that there is such a commandment. And so if they go ahead and they bear false witness against the neighbor, then in that case, they don't have to be warned. Hey, do you know that there's a penalty for bearing false witness against your neighbor? Something like that.
You know,
yeah.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
I was reading over a today in Israeli legal practice.
Yeah.
I was reading over a declaration, simple form declaration, somebody that's a witness to someone else's will. And it says, the notary, whatever, says that hisharti etchem she he mukrachim let's say la morata emet im lo kol ha'anashim shel ha'chok.
Yeah,
in other words,
yeah.
I'm warning you that you must tell the truth,
right, yeah.
And if you don't, all
yeah,
the punishments
the penalties,
of the law
right, the
will apply
yeah.
to you. So
right,
I wonder
right. yeah.
about this, that maybe
yeah.
David has a point here, that
yeah.
even that even it's in our tradition that the warning be more proximate in time. Because after all, who are we talking about? Maybe some of these people were shepherds, or whatever, they may have learned this in Cheder. They may have seen it once in their lives.
Yeah.
They may not have really retained it. And they come as men in their 20s and 30s, and as you say, become hot-tempered and wish to kill somebody or whatever, or come into court and wish to do an injustice to their neighbor. And really not retain this warning they have, because you're not
well,
dealing
but
with...
Well, really, with the case of Adam Zimmerman, I mean, it's not exactly the same thing as, you know, warning a murderer that, or a potential murderer, that if he commits murder, then he can expect...
In other words, ignorance of the law is not an excuse.
Right.
Well,
right.
Not only that, but
in a sense, yeah. I mean, but that's not our law.
Yeah.
In your scenario, however, no one would come to the court unless he understood the laws of witnesses.
Is that so?
And not only that, the witnesses are interrogated beforehand. Right, Phil?
Pardon me?
And the witnesses are interrogated before they come in. They're told about the responsibility
yeah,
of being a witness.
Well,
right,
then that's
right.
a warning.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
a warning.
That's
yeah.
what I'm trying
to
say.
Before they testify.
That they have,
yeah.
they,
before
yeah.
they testify.
This is true, of course, in capital punishment cases. Yeah.
But what about the other cases? What about the ones
the other cases?
About the Mammon?
How could someone who's completely...
I don't know, really, whether... I mean, then... There may be something or other, but it's not brought out over here.
It's not brought out. It's
not brought out.
It's not
no,
clear.
You,
okay.
you have
right.
to volunteer as a witness, right?
Yeah.
No one would go to court unless
yes.
he knew the court system voluntarily. You know, these are witnesses who are walking in and saying, I saw this man do something.
Right.
So in order to have the knowledge that this is the way the court system works...
He has a point, because they're not just witnesses, they're accusers.
No,
really,
of course
right?
they're accusers,
okay, so
absolutely.
Yeah, you would have to
right
know.
About that.
You would have to
yeah.
be a little bit more...
Of course.
Yeah.
Okay,
Yashikaya, let's continue.
You lost that one.
Never, don't tangle with the English.
So in any case, right. So, Mahalehim Zomimim, he says, right, look, you're taking the story of the Eben Zomimim, Shekain Ein Tzvichin Hasra, they do not require Hasra, nevertheless, they get punished, right? So, can't we say that Motzi Shemra Yochiyach, that, you know, the Motzi Shemra should also, after all, he gets punishment, gets a double punishment and so on, so wouldn't we say that that's the case? But the answer is, guess what? No. Because in the case of the Motzi Shemra, he must also be warned. He does have Hasra. So only Adam Zomimin is a case where there is no Hasra. No, if that's the case, then again, we're left with the idea that you cannot compare Adam Zomimin to the Motzi Shemra.
Right.
And so they say, the Chozer Hadin, lo re'izeh, kere'izeh, v'lo re'izeh, kere'izeh. As we analyze the two, we see that a point in this one doesn't correspond to a point in the other one, and a point in the other one doesn't correspond to a point in this one.
Hmm.
And what do they have in common? What's the common denominator? Hatzad Hashove Shabahen. You know, that the common denominator that they have is Lav She'en Bo Maaseh, that they are love, which do not have, you know, any actual deed, and nevertheless, but lo ken olav, and they get malchus. But of course, as we said before, whose opinion is that?
That's Rabbi
Akiva. That's Rabbi Yehuda's idea, right? And ultimately, it may be Rabbi Meir's idea. This is what we're saying, okay? And so, therefore, af kol lav shem b'maaseh lo ken olav, right? So the conclusion that we should say is that any love which doesn't have any actual, you know, deed connected with it, so you get malchus for it for violating it. But not so. Mala atzara shavshu behen. Let's take another point. Shekain kanas. We say that in both cases, you know, you say that the motzi shemra definitely is considered a case of kanas. Can you say also that Adam Zomimin is a case of kanas? Or is it only, maybe not knas, but it's mamo? It's not a special amount of money, for example, that is levied against them as in the case of knas, where the Torah said, you know, that it might be 100, or in another case it would be 50, or it may say double punishment, you know, you pay twice the amount, or you pay four or five times the amount, you know, whatever it may be. Those are knas. Everybody is in agreement about that. But can you say in the case of the Edom Zomimin, if they say, look, he owes 200 zuz, and we testify to that fact, so they're not paying 400 zuz, they pay only the 200 zuz. Okay? So you can't consider that knas. So how can you consider them? So he says, holo kasha, he says, no, that's not a kasha. Why? Because Rabbi Yehuda, lo yisuba lo ke Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Yehuda simply is not in agreement with Rabbi Akiva. That's all. Each one has their own opinion. That's all. So, getting back to another common denominator, so to speak. Ela ma'at sad ha'shavish ha'bahen. Shekein yesh bahen sad chomur. Right? That in each case there is a certain severity which exists. What is the severity? The fact is, you know, that for example, in the case of the Motzi Shemra, that's easy to see. He has to pay money, and he also gets malchus, right? So what about in Eden Zomimim, what would be the Tzad HaChomer? Well, if you hold like Rabbi Meir, so the Tzad HaChomer would be that you also would have to
get
both, right? But he says, for Rabbi Yehuda, Tzad HaChomer Leporech, Rabbi Yehuda isn't asking a question about the Tzad HaChomer. Each one is entitled to it. So, Rabbonim. Okay. So, if that's the case, we get back to what? Final conclusion. A. That Rabbi Meir feels that they should get both. Tachomim are in disagreement. No matter which way we slice it, whether you try to make a comparison between Adam Zomimin and the Motzi Shemra or not, and so on, or on what basis, Lav Shem B'Masa maybe, or the Tzikanaz, whatever it may be, and so on and so forth, but we have to discount the whole business, because in the final analysis we're left with what? With the conclusion that the Chachamim disagree, and they say what? What the Mishnah said. Mechayvel Kedei Rishachas, right? Gets one, but not the other. Alright, so, if he gets one punishment, so, that's the case, then now they ask the next question. Rabbonon, Hilo Sana Briachai Shoka my Doshibe. What do they do with this? This gets back to what? What did Rabbi Meir say? He said there are two psukim that are involved, right? One pasuk says, thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor, and the other one says that you know, Adam Zomimim, they get malchus. But Yisroso, right, and he has to get his punishment, which is malchus. Okay? So, what do they do with Lo Sana Briachai Et Shoka, since they're only penalizing him for what? Not for being Zomim, and that is not for telling false witness, but they're penalizing him only because whatever they wanted to do, the other guy, this is the penalty that they pay, right? So what do they do with this pasuk? So he says, okay, they use it as a general warning, you know, that giving false testimony, including acting as an aided servant, is wrong. Okay. And as I explained, you know, before, the Azhara is the warning that you have. So afterwards, then if you violate after you know that it's wrong, so then you're liable to punishment. But just for the warning itself, you don't get punishment. Okay? For Rabbi Meir, how about him? After all, he's also in agreement that there has to be Asorah. So he says, Asorah leidim zevim min ole. Where does he derive it? So it's Omer Rabbi Yirmi. He says, Nafkelei, he derives it from a different pasuk altogether. He derives it from the Hanisharim Yishmu v'Yirahu v'lo Yosifu Oid. It says that all the other people, when they see this guy getting his malchus, right, they will hear, they will see what's going on, and they will not continue to sin anymore along these lines.
Refrain from being false witnesses.
So now, next question, Rabbonon. And how about the sages? How about them, Chachamim? What do they do with this pasuk on Yisharim Yishmu Yiro, right? V'lo Yosifu Od. So, what do they do with it? So he says, Ahum Miboy Lei, they need it for something else. What do they need it for? They need it for Lehachroza. Achroza means that in certain particular cases, a public declaration has to be made that so and so is being punished precisely because he violated this and this thing. And as Rashi says up on the top over there, you see in Lachroza,
yeah,
it says that in that chapter it's written over there that Arbo'ot Tzirichin Hachroza, right? La'achar Shanen Shub Bezdin. There are four different types of cases where a public announcement has to be made concerning, you know, what they did wrong after they have been punished. And Tzrichim Bezdin Ahachris, and the Bezdin has to make a public announcement. Kach v'kach Neharag, right? So and so was given capital punishment, right? Neharag, Ploni, it doesn't make very much sense, but Bezdin Aladeira Ploni. So, in other words, the Ploni really should be for, Kach v'kach Neharag. Oh, okay. Kach v'kach, right, Tony. I get it, what Rashi is trying to say. Because sometimes...
You don't have punctuation.
No, there's no... You have to sort of get the swing of it. Okay. It says, under these and these circumstances, that's what he means by kach v'kach over here, okay? Under these circumstances, Tony, in other words, so-and-so was given capital punishment, right? Bevesdin, by the Bezdin. Aladeira plonis, because of this and this sin, right? And what is the reason for it? It's today, Lirdosis Hashomim. This is in order to impress those who hear about it that they should not be tempted, to do the same thing that he did. So this is why. And of course, one of those four mentioned in the Gemara in Sanhedrin happens to be in the case of Zomimim. That after the Zomimim have been punished, then in that particular case, the Bezdin also must make a public declaration that these people, were punished as Edom Zomimim, this and this was their punishment because they did this and this Avera. Okay?
That was a punishment too.
Of course.
Be shamed in public.
Absolutely. But the idea is not so much to shame them in public
as it is in order to
warn people, that they should not violate these things. Okay?
Now, what is being used for that? It's not that's for not to bear false witness, or for the Edom Zomimim.
The Hanishorim Yishmu V'Yirah, that the other people, right, will hear and they will see, and over Yirah, that they should be afraid. Really, it's a better translation.
Yeah,
okay. Okay, that they will hear and they will be afraid, and they will not do any more this kind of another.
Why is it proper? There are four times you have to make a proper.
It's under four circumstances. The others would apply to different types of punishment. Okay, but this is one of the four that require public.
And what is the reference for that? Where is that?
That's it. What is the?
He's looking for the proof text for that.
In other words, is that the...
they derive it from here.
No. He means, where do they get the instruction to make the proclamation in those four cases?
Deuteronomy 19, verse 10.
Yeah.
Yeah, you want to take a look in Devarim, chapter 19. You'll see the pasuk over there, and this is how they touch the pasuk. That's the point.
Okay.
They touch the pasuk this way, right?
That's what David is referring to, right, David?
Yeah.
Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
Yes, yes, yes. Okay, David, read the pasuk. Make it the official reader.
I'm trying to see if there's any context.
Yeah.
Irving, you put that in the footnote there, right?
Yeah.
Something about fruit trees. That's good.
Fruit trees.
We're not fruits.
Here we go.
Loud.
Okay. Actually, you've got to go back to the beginning of the chapter for it to make sense.
Yeah.
Let's skip to. I'll skip to thou shalt not remove thy neighbor's landmark. This is verse 40. Which they had all the time said, in thy inheritance which thou shalt
share
in the land of the Lord thy God, give thee to possess it. Next.
Yeah.
One witness shall not rise up against a man for any iniquity, for any sin, in any sin that he sinneth. At the matter of two witnesses, or at the matter of three witnesses, shall not have to be established.
Right.
If an unrighteous witness rise up against any man to bear perverted witness against him, then both the men between whom the controversy is shall stand before the Lord, before the priests and the judges that shall be in those days. And the judges shall inquire diligently, and behold, if the witness be a false witness and have testified falsely against his brother, then shall you do unto him as he had purposed to do unto his brother, so shall thou put away the evil from the midst of thee. And those that remain shall hear and hear and
that's
shall
the
henceforth.
Right. Those that remain shall hear. Yes, for Hanisha Shall Yeshua Yisrael.
There it is.
Yeah. Okay.
And I shall not pity life,
but
life I choose to do. Amen.
That's the proof text.
All right. Okay. So, does Rabbi Meir also require a public announcement? The answer is yes. Rabbi Meir, Hachroza. Where does he derive it? He says, also, Yishma Yirah Nafka. He gets it also from the same pasuk. But what is the Azhara? The Azhara that he gets is V'lo Yosifu Azos, right? That they shall not continue. In other words, other people shall not continue to do it. So the point is, they're not in disagreement about this. They're only in disagreement about what kind of actual penalties they get.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we have time.
Five after now.
Yeah. All right. We'll start the new Mishnah. Actually, it's a Mishnah that we had already quoted before.
Well, there's only a minute here, you see, so I want to...
Yeah, right,
if
right.
If somebody else walks
right,
in, then I'll
right,
take
right,
out.
Okay.
Well,
yeah.
You've got to stay till 8:10. You've got to stay till this time.
No, he's talking about the Shiva minion.
Yeah, the Shiva minion, No, we understand. But, listen, we have to keep a minion going over here, too, you know. No question about that. All right. The Mishnah says, Mishal Shemim Homon, V'ein Mishal Shemim Akas. We had this quoted previously, but this is the locus, as we would say. This is the place where actually it belongs in the text, okay? Now, Mishal Shem is, of course, from the word Shalosh. But as we learned at that time when we had it, here it means really that they divide up the money penalty that they are assessed. In other words, let's say 200 zuz. If you have two witnesses who ate in Zomimim, then how much do they have to pay? Each one pays 100, correct. But if they deserve Malkus, then in that particular case, then they have to get the full amount. There's no such thing. Right, each one. You don't divvy up the Malkus. You say, okay, you take. Now, as Rashi pointed out when we first came across this, he says, Mishalshin, why does it say Mishalshin? Because of the fact that what if you have three witnesses? So in that case, you would divvy it up not on the basis of two, but divvy it up, you know, one third of the amount. And if you have four or five and six and so on, as Rashi said at that time, that's also okay. But as far as Malkos, each one gets the right. Because they're getting the Malkos for a different penalty. That's the reason why. So this is what the Mishnah says, Mishal Shemim Ma'amon, that when it comes to a money penalty, it can be split up. But the ain't Mishal Shemim Malkos. When it comes to Malkos, each one has to get it. Ketzad. Example. Hey, do hu shu chayv l'chaveh masayim zuz, right? If they testify that, he owes the other guy 200 zuz. V'nim su zemimin, and they are discovered, you know, to be Zoymimin, then in that case, Mishal Shimbeinahim, they split it among themselves, that is the money. Avol, Im Heiduhu Shuchayev Malkus Aboim, but if they testified that he deserves 40 Malkus, Venimsu Zoymimin, and they are found to be Zoymimin, then call Echel the Echel Loki Aboim. I have to add one other thing that is obvious from the Mishnah over here, and that is, we have now learned in the previous Mishnah that what? That the Chachamim say that if he deserves both Malkus and money, then if he pays the money, that's right. So that therefore, over here, what the Mishnah seems to be implying is that in reality we're talking about two different things. One is money, where we say in the case of money, that can be split among these Edom Zomim, but if they testify that so-and-so deserves Malkus because he committed a certain Avera, then in that case they have to get the full complement of Malkus, each one of them. This is what the mission is. Well, we'll stop at this point because it's time to talk about it now.
Are we ready?
We are now on Daf Hey. We're continuing with the first citation from the Gemara that followed the Mishnah that we did last
and
week.
And it is August 2nd.
August the 2nd. Gabal, where did the summer go? With this heat, we're not going to be so sorry to see the summer go. I don't know.
I'll play it back in December.
Anyway, the Gemara says, Benohani Mili. You know, Benohani Mili always means, you know, where in the Torah do we find the reference to this, right? How do we derive this from the Torah? So, Omar Abaye, Abaye says, Nema Rosh Bechavi Malkiyos, Nema Rosh Bechavi Mises. Okay, in other words, what is he doing? He's making the Zera Shabbat. The word Rosh occurs both in reference to people who deserve the death penalty, and the word Rosh also occurs in the Torah in reference to people who deserve Malkus. What's precisely are the quotations, the citations, if you wish. So Menohani Miller, so as Rashi says, we'll take a look at the Rashi here is not too hard. Says Menohani Miller, how do we know these things? The Chol Echot Sevigs V'Aboim, you know that each person is going to get the full 40 Malkus. So we said there's Rosh HaVachai V'Misos. What is the pasuk there? It says Hashem Hu Rosh HaLamus. In reference to a person who deserves the death penalty, it says they're not allowed to take any money in order to spring a person who deserves the death penalty. Okay? Hashem Hu Rosh HaLamus. He is a Rosh, and therefore he deserves the death penalty.
Right.
And how about Nechai V'Malkos? So it says over there, the pasuk says, "Im bin hakos harasha." If this wicked man deserves to be given makos, okay, so that therefore the two, both of these cases have the word rasha in them. Okay, so if that's the case, says Abaye, "Ma lahalonin misalemetze." Even as in the latter case, we cannot have a person who's only half executed.
Half dead.
Right, half dead. I mean, we sometimes use the expression poetically, but obviously if the person is alive or he's dead, that's all. Okay. So, just as we cannot inflict only a half death penalty, so Afkan ain't Malkus Lemetze. So, likewise, in this case, you cannot inflict only half Malkus. In other words, divvy it up, you get 20, I get 20. Rabbi Omar, the Rabbi says, look, we have another pasuk, and that pasuk says, "Beinon, we require kasher zoma v'lasos the yochiv v'leka." In the case of Edom Zomimim, we have the punishment, right, by the punishment which they wanted to have imposed upon the guy, you know, whom they were accusing, right? And in this particular case, it doesn't work out. Why doesn't it work out in this case? Because obviously, they testified again. Of course, we're talking about the latter case. You know, we're talking about a person who deserves Malkus. Okay, mm-hmm. They said that this guy committed a crime, which was punishable by Malkus. Right, mm-hmm. Therefore, he gets the 40 Malkus. So, this is what they wanted to have that guy you know, punished with, right? So in that case, what should be their punishment?
Bumping.
They have to get the same. So right. That therefore, each person now in this particular case has to get the 40 malchus. Right. Okay. The result is going to be the same, but it's only, you know, a question of, you know, where do you find a proof text, you see, for the point. Okay? So, now, the Gemara says, yeah, well, if this is the case, Hochi Mame Name, if you go with what Rava had to say, namely that, you know, you have to give him the punishment that he wanted to give to the other guy, right? So, why in the case of the money did we say in the Mishnah, the first part of this Mishnah, that money can be divided among the Edom Zemimim? It could be divided two ways, could be divided three ways, depending upon how many people come forth with the testimony, right? It could even be four ways and so on, okay? So, why do we say that? I mean, shouldn't this principle apply likewise to them? They wanted to cause him to lose 200 zuz, so each one of them should be paying him 200 zuz. And yet we learned nothing doing. Instead, they divvy it up. So, the Gemara is, Momoin Mitztori says, the principle is that money can be added together to form one principal sum, so to speak, right? Whereas Malkos, look, story. In the case, yes, we're doing right. The Gemara on the first Mishnah over there. Yeah, we're up on the top over there. Yeah, right over there. Oh, okay. But, you know, money can be added together. I could add 100 here and 100 there, and I'll get 200 to that. So, well, that's the sum that they wanted him to pay. So, okay, so that's it. But in the case of Malkos, you cannot add up Malkos. Why? So, we'll take a look at Rashi. Rashi says over there, right, Tashe Zomam, Sheikabil Hanodoin, Malkus Shleimo. They wanted, you know, the person who was being judged by the court to receive a full complement of Malkus, in other words, 40, so that therefore, you know, they should each be given 40, right? And he says, Momim Mitzarev, Vihare Kibil Masherotzul Hafsidil Ben Kulam. And after all, the guy, you know, against whom they were testifying for, so he got the amount of money, you know, that they wanted him to lose. They said that he owes 200 even though it wasn't true, so he got his 200. This was the assessment. But in the case of Malkus, as we said before, Malkus cannot be, you can't add them together. Each one as an individual has to get the same. Okay.
But the court doesn't make anything on it.
No.
The lawyers do, don't worry.
Well, you have to realize they didn't really have lawyers in those days.
Good old days.
They didn't, right. In those days, you know, it was the judges and it was the witnesses.
Right. It is.
Yeah. And of course, the defendant had the right to defend himself. I mean, you know, there's no question about that. I mean, if he could find it, you know, if he would, what shall we say, if he could be malamed zchus upon himself, we have to listen to what he has to say. Yes.
When did the institution of the toein come into play then?
That came in a much later period.
I don't know what the toein is.
A toein is like a person, you know, who knows how to arrange, how to plead your case, you know, how to present your arguments in accordance with, let's say, Torah law or something like that.
My niece, who's a lawyer in Jerusalem, is taking a course to be a toein.
That's interesting.
Well, it's like words in Westminster Abbey.
You can't
I'm just
hear
getting
it
a little
anyway,
bit of my own back here. But look, if the loss that they wanted to cost him was 200 zuzim, for example, right? Mm-hmm. So why then would he get a windfall if, let's say, there were three accusers? Why should he then receive 600?
That's
what I'm trying to say. So I don't have a problem with the fact that the financial penalty is split. Because to make him whole, all he needs is to get the 200 zuzim that he was being caused to lose. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I can see it as a kind of a chesed. If we think that 39 malchot are severe, how can you give somebody 120 malchot or whatever? In other words, so on the other side, I see it as a fair judgment.
Well, this we
also
understand. I mean, nobody's going to, right. I mean, this is why when Rabbi Meir proposed in the previous Mishnah, you know, that, you know, it's just like a Mishalem. In other words, he not only, you know, he gets malchus, but, you know, he has to pay the penalty. Or if he said that this guy should get, you know, 40 and 40, two different things, you know, so... he should get then, 80 malchus and so on and
he
so
said
forth.
No,
yeah, well, but, you know, Chachamim knocked down that theory. They said that it's not applicable, that's all. Yeah.
But if there are three Eidos, they each get 40.
Yes,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah,
that's
20
anyway.
Well,
but it's not. It's within the realm of justice and doesn't trespass into cruelty.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Good evening.
Good evening, sorry.
It's okay.
Okay,
I don't know who
line.
She is.
Yeah.
She
yeah?
must be looking for a client.
Yeah. The sun and shine is away.
He's away.
I don't know. All right, so far, this part was not hard, but now we come to a Mishnah which is going to introduce some difficult Gemara concepts. And, okay, we'll take it line by line. All right, Mishnah now says, Ein hoedim nasim zomimim ad sheyezim esatzmo. Literally, it says, witnesses do not become edim zomimim until they can actually, literally, accuse themselves. Now, what do you mean accuse themselves? Because the answer is that
they
the testimony
themselves.
That they give, right, is enough, you know, to indict them that they are false witnesses. Okay. There are other readings, as we'll see. Yeah, we can take a look at the Rashi, how he explains it over there. She is even Satzman. You see that? She is even.
Yeah.
Now what he's done is Sheyazimu Osan, it's not Esatzman. You notice he changed the interpretation around. Because Sheyazimu Esatzman means that they accuse themselves of it. In other words, they bring themselves about by their testimony to make themselves liable. It's their testimony. But what Rashi is, in accordance with the Gemara, he says that until they will be accused, Sheyazimu Osan, that others literally, right? The day is, the indefinite day. In other words, people will accuse them. The Iske Gufon, and this we'll learn means about literally their body, but what it means is, where these guys were. The Lobe Iske Ahoreg, their Horeg. This is an important thing that we're going to be seeing in the Gemara, and not in reference to who the murderer is, or who the victim, who was the murdered victim was, because that's already a different story, as the Gemara is going to explain. All right, now here comes another business. Okay, good evening. Is it actually raining now?
Yes, it's thunder.
Okay. All right, so the Mishnah says as follows: says Ketza, for example, Omru me'ininonu be'ish pleini shehorges hanefesh. They come and they say as follows: we testify against so and so that he murdered so and so, right? So Omrulahem, so they say unto these witnesses, Eichatem Yidin, how can you testify Shahare Neherag Zeh O Hahoreg Zeh Hoyo Imonu Osahayom? How can you give testimony when either the Neherag, in other words, the murder victim, right? This murder victim, or this murderer, was with us that very day, be more complaining, the different, in such and such a place.
Right.
Right? So how could you come and give testimony concerning them? So what does the Mishnah say? The Mishnah says, Ein Eilu Zomimim. These are not considered Eidim Zomimim. In other words, what is the court saying to them? The court is saying to them, how can you testify that you saw so-and-so kill A, right, in place B,
when you weren't,
when on this very day we saw
A,
that A was in B together with us?
Yeah.
So they are not considered zomimim because they are not testifying about the testimony given, you understand? They're not testifying about the testimony that they themselves claim that they saw. because they didn't see it, since the other group said, you know, look, we know, we saw the murder, and then we saw the murder victim, so it has nothing to do. All right. So,
what
are
they testifying about?
What are they testifying? Okay. They are testifying as follows. Okay. They say that...
apparently there are two sets of witnesses, right?
Yes. In all probability, because Adam Zomim normally required two sets of witnesses.
Yeah.
Okay?
All right.
So the second set of witnesses, they come along and they say, you say that you saw so-and-so murdered in such and such a place.
Right.
But we were there and we saw the murder take place. Okay? So that therefore, these the first group now will not be considered Adam Zomim. Why?
They don't say that here. They just say that we saw the murderer and the...
We saw them
and the victim together, right? Zahare Nefelah Zahoh Haforeg Zahayat Manu.
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't say that they want witness to acts of murder. They just said they saw them.
Okay.
Together.
But what are the second set of witnesses coming to say? They're not coming to say that you're a bunch of liars because we were with you. That makes them into Adam Zomim. And this is what the Mishnah will say now. It's a technicality. All right, take a look again. All right, It's a technicality. All right. He says, Kesef, right? How does this work out? Omru Mid and Onabish Plaini, right? These Adam who are Zemimim, right? And they say, we testify against so-and-so that he murdered someone. All right? So along come a new set of witnesses, right? Omru Lahem, and they say to the first set of witnesses whom they are now accusing of being Adam Zomimim, right? How can you testify when either the victim or the murderer was together with us that very day in a different place, right? Not where you say you saw it. So in that particular case, they are not... Who is the second set of witnesses? Who are they testifying about? They're testifying about the original deed, but they are not testifying about what?
The witnesses.
They're not claiming that the witnesses were false because they were with them. They're testifying about the original deed over there. Okay.
They're testifying with them.
Yeah. It's a distinction,
they can't
right?
They can't prove directly the perjury of the first witness.
That's right.
All they're saying is
right.
That they weren't there.
They're saying, right, they weren't there at all, so, you know, their testimony has, you know, doesn't mean anything. Okay? All right. Avol Omru Lahem, but what if they said, in other words, the second set of witnesses come along and they say to them, Eich atem eidim, how can you give testimony? Sha'arei atem eisim imonu also hayom b'mokam pleni? Since you were together with us that particular day, in this place, then ha'arei eidu zomimim. Then these are really eidim zomimim, b'nei rog and alpihem. And as a result, because they wanted to, cause the first person, to be executed, so in this particular case, their punishment will be that, accordance with the testimony of the second set of witnesses, they themselves, the Adam Zimmerman, will deserve the death penalty. Okay? Now comes another thing. Bo Acher, one of another group of witnesses now comes, right? The Hizumim, and they say, hey, these guys are Adam Zimmerman, right? Then Bo Acher Mizimim. Now comes along another set of witnesses and say, they're a bunch of liars, okay? They're Adam Zomim.
Hold on.
Yes.
How many sets of witnesses now?
Is this a different case we've got now?
It could be. That's a generalization. It's a generalization. It applies to any case where Adam Zomim have come and given testimony, okay? As we'll see, I'll explain to you in a second.
Okay.
I'll explain to you in a second that there is a difference of opinion as to how to understand this part of the Mishnah. Okay. Yes.
I'm sorry, could you just go over the Mishpat? Ba'u Acherim.
Right.
Ha-Zimum.
The Hizimum, right. Borachim Hizimum, right. In other words, another set of witnesses came along and said that they are Zemimim, right? Along came another set of witnesses and said that they were Zemimim, right?
So they're now a number of corroborative...
Correct. Afilu Meyo. Even if there were 100. So the Mishnah says, in other words, 100 sets of witnesses, right? So, Kulam Yeherogu. Then they all deserve to be put to death. Why? Because along comes somebody's testimony, and what does he say? He says, this group were a bunch of liars, and this group were a bunch of liars, and this group were a bunch of liars, because they were all together with us. This would be the implication. They were all together with us on this day, so they, you know, how could they even give that testimony? So every set that was being accused of being Adam Zimmerman, they all deserved the death penalty, right? This is the way Mishnah comes out right now. The difficulty, of course, is obvious.
Yeah, there's 100 people saying one thing.
Right, correct. That's one great big problem. And how could they all be crowded into the same room together, for example, or something like that, you understand? So that's why there are different ways to understand this particular Mishnah. The first one that I gave you is the way Rashi understands it, namely that one group after another comes and repeats the same false witness, false testimony, right? And so therefore, what is the punishment of each one of them? So the answer is that they deserve the death penalty. It wouldn't make any difference whether there's only one set of false witnesses or 100 sets of false witnesses. That's how Rashi understands the Mishnah, okay? But there are others who understand the Mishnah a little bit different. They understand that it means, okay, first comes set A of witnesses, right? And set A testifies, you know, that they saw this guy murdered. Okay, along comes set B and says, set A, they're Adam Zimmerman because they were together with us. Okay, now along comes set C and says, oh, hold on, he says, witnesses B, they were together with us. Yeah, along comes set D and says, wait a minute, set C was together with us, and so on and so forth. So as we can see, this already brings a different situation altogether. How many sets of Adam Zimmerman, I mean, you're going to put to death, you see, under the circumstances. So at any rate, we'll see that even though right now the, you know, the anonymous Mishnah, so to speak, says that every one of them has to be put to death, but Rabbi Yehuda says, Istatis Izu. Istatis is a question, exactly what does it mean? We'll see how Rashi understands it in a moment. But the obvious meaning, you know, is something like, this is like conniving or a conspiracy or something like that. This is how we have to understand it, right? Okay?
The group of five.
Right. Yeah, if you wish, okay. The Einu Neherag Elekata Rishon Bilvad, and only the first group of witnesses, only the first ones, you know, those, the original people who were, let's say, accused. In other words, group A.
Who made the original
accusation. Who made the original accusation, only they are to be put to death. Okay? So, this is how the Mishnah reads. Let's take a look at the Rashi now. We've already done the first one.
It doesn't make sense either if you have the first interpretation.
Yeah.
If they all are coming, and obviously it's the weight of the evidence, they're trying by, might say by the to call it a language, by the brute force of the number of witnesses to convince the Dayanim
right.
that of the guilt of the other. So to me, it would seem that they would equally share in the guilt.
Right.
Because they're all
well, this is the question, right?
They're all conspiring. They're all plotting.
Well, actually, I mean, the Shulchan Aruch itself paskens in accordance with the anonymous Mishnah over here. Anonymous Mishnah says that they're all a bunch of connivers, and they all deserve the same death penalty, you see. This is what the halacha is, the psak halacha. This is the way it is, okay, in spite of what Rabbi Yehuda exactly had to say over here. All right, getting back to the Rashi over here, and then we'll continue with Gemara, as I say. Gets a little bit involved over here. Okay. All right. Boachir, right? So along comes another set, because I already did the first one, right? That Rashi makes the point that when do they become Adam Zomimim? When the new set of witnesses come along and testify about the witnesses, not about the deed itself. Not about the Horeg and not about the Neherag, but Guf Atzman. In other words, the witnesses themselves. Okay? So, Bo Achim now comes along his second set, right? Sheheidu Allah of Kedis Rishonim, and you know, they testify concerning him, you know, that just as the first set of witnesses. So the hizimu elu hashnayim shehizimu harishonim hizimu gam esvachreinim, and the first group, this is how Rashi understands it. Okay, remember, group A come along and they make an accusation, right? Okay, along comes group B, and what do they say? They say that group A are a bunch of Edom Zomim. Okay? Along comes group C, and what do they say? They agree with what group A had to say. Okay? This is how Rashi understands it. So along comes group B, and said, B.
Yeah.
B. This is how Rashi understands it. Group B says, look, group A were a bunch of liars, they were Edom Zomim in. Right? And group C are also a bunch of liars. They are also Edom Zomim. Alright, this is how Rashi understands it. Alright? That's what he says. Shehizimu harishonim, right? Elo hashnayim. These two, in other words, what I call group B in this case, right? Shehizimu harishonim, who declared, you know, that the first witnesses, in other words, group A, were a bunch of Edom Zomim. So, Shehizimu gamasu achrayinim. So group C too, the new group that came along, Bo Achirim, right? They're also refuted by whom? By group B, right? So Afilu, even Im Hein Meo Kitos Zu Achazu, even if there are 100 groups of witnesses who come and all testify in accordance with what group A had to say, right? The Chat Achaz is Imosan, and one group of witnesses declares that every one of the other groups are a bunch of Edom Zomimim, then in that case, Kulon Dehoregu, they are all to be put to death, because this is what they propose to do to the guy. Okay?
How does the judge know who to believe that?
Well, then, so Rashi then also accepts this conspiracy theory.
Yes.
They all conspire, they're all to be put to death.
Right. So, istatis hizu, right? What is his status? So, he says, Hakat Hazos, namely, this group. Tachel Edus Sorov Satyahi. This is a group, he says, of giving testimony which is Sorah. Sorah means it's perverse, so to speak, literally departing, you know, from the right path, right? Yeah. It's perverse. This Satya. And Satya also in Aramaic, you know, Sote, actually it's related, you know, to the idea of the Sota. The Sota. What is the Sota? She strayed, you know, from the right path. So this is how he explains it, that it's sort of a satya, and that's how he gets the word istatis. Others, by the way, say that it's from a Greek word, which means like conspiracies. No, the group, I mean, in Greek, I mean, the general root means to mean to be standing. From this, we have words like stationary and things like that. So, right? I mean, it's on a star in Latin, but that's related to the Greek idea too.
Mm.
So that what he's saying is that they seem to be standing together as a group in order to give false testimony. Okay. So hikach not lo eitzah b'nehem lahazim es kol haba lehoid olav. It seems, he says, that they decided among themselves to declare as Edom Zomimim any group who would come in order to testify. So this is why you know, Rabbi Yehuda feels that only the first group really deserves the penalty, because they were the original ones, and at this point, whoever is going to come, group B is going to declare they're a bunch of liars. So this is how Rashi understood it. And as I told you, the alternate way is to consider, you know, that B cancels out A, C cancels out B, and so on and so forth. But that also, it involves all kinds of mental gymnastics, as you can see, I mean, as to how to assign guilt.
How do they prove which set of witnesses are telling the truth?
They can only prove it on the basis of, do they actually have corroborative you know, testimony that Imonu Hayisen, you were together with us on this particular day, in this particular place. This is what Edom Zomim are. Okay? That's the only way that they can do it. In the court of law, we're not dealing now with where you have two sets of witnesses who give conflicting ideas of what they saw. Remember, the Edom Zomimim are accused, you know, of not being there on the scene, you know, to see about what's going on. Their testimony is being, you know, it's being attacked on the basis, you know, that these are a bunch of liars. They couldn't be because they never saw the original event and so on and so forth. Whereas, and of course, you know, it was a conspiracy on their part in order to hurt somebody else, okay. Whereas, let's say that you have two sets of witnesses who saw the same event, and yet each one gives conflicting testimony. And in that particular case, the judges find it very difficult to know how to decide a case.
That's probably why they don't consider them Edom Zomim. In other words, I have difficulty with this because it seems like it's, on the face of it, it seems as if in the first instance they are Edom Zomim. They're coming and they're accusing someone of very serious crime.
Right.
And they were not even, another group of witnesses comes to show that they saw the actual crime being committed, and the facts don't match up at all. This would seem to imply false testimony.
Yeah.
But I think maybe what they're talking about is, let's say you're in a shuk and you had two sets of witnesses that see the same event, and one gives mistaken testimony, but maybe intentionally mistaken.
Right. I mean, if one says that, for example, let's say the murderer was wearing a brown scarf, and the other one comes and says he was wearing a black scarf or a gray scarf or something like that. You understand? That's already conflict. Right. And in that case, the judge would really be in a difficult position to know who is telling the truth. So if that's the case, then there's a good likelihood, you know, that the person who is accused would be set free, okay, because of the conflicting evidence against them.
But in the second case, it's almost like an out. I mean, it's like Makom Hayir Hayu. I mean, Hayinu. In other words, like they're coming and saying, look, they can't possibly have witnessed the murder at all because we were all over in Acheron's party and they were with us.
Right, right.
That makes them
into Zedumim, right? Because they're testifying that these witnesses were with them. They're not testifying what they saw in the court.
Right.
And what they saw, the murder that was being carried out or whatever. Yeah. If in the actual case itself, it was not a question of Edom Zomimim, but simply witnesses who have conflicts in the testimony, they have conflicting testimony, understand? In that particular case, the judge has a very great difficulty in knowing what to do. The judge is either they have to free the person, or maybe they could, work out some kind of an alternate punishment or something like that.
In the second case, the actual murder becomes subsidiary.
Yeah.
Nobody's actually testifying.
Right, they're not testifying.
They're not
testifying to
the crime of false
testimony. Exactly. They're only testifying to the witnesses. They're not testifying to them. That's the difference between making them into Edom Zomimim as compared to the first case that the Mishnah brought over here, where they say, look, we were there, we saw what happened, and we were together with the murderer or with the victim and so on. So how could you be telling the truth? But
exactly.
As we said, in Edom, then these are not Edom Zomimim.
I don't understand the overall thing of how... If the testimony is given in confidence, how does the second set of witnesses...
I don't understand by testimony.
Sorry, okay.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
No,
if they're being interrogated in confidence...
Correct.
Okay,
yeah,
how does group B know what group A has said? How does group B know, in fact, that group A are the witnesses?
Well... Obviously, there is probably some kind of a public declaration made after the judges have had an opportunity to judge, to weigh the evidence and come to some sort of a decision.
In which case...
Okay? Edom Zomimim in general,
If the public is kept aware of what's going on, then Group C wouldn't appear because they would have heard that Group B has already invalidated Group A.
No.
necessarily.
Not necessarily.
They would certainly appear because they come to impeach the testimony of
group B and
corroborate the testimony of group A.
They come to confirm group A's testimony.
Sure. Right?
If they know that group B is discredited group A, they'd be suicidal to come in and say, I agree with group A, because group A has already been found to be witnesses.
I don't know. See, these are the questions we have to understand. It's how the Sanhedrin
works.
But if the Sanhedrin doesn't indicate what their thinking is or their decision is, they won't know. If the Sanhedrin listens to group A, listens to group B, group C, who are in league with group A, decides to come forward and save the day, so to speak, they come and they walk in the trap. Because the Sanhedrin hasn't yet, as we would say, come down hard on group B as being liars.
The Gemara, of course, in Sanhedrin, which gives a description of how the courts were working and so on.
No, group A are liars.
Yeah. They speak about, you know,
group
the
A, I'm sorry, group
right.
A,
yeah.
Group
they
A.
Speak about the importance, for example, of how to check the witnesses, to ask them all kinds of penetrating questions and things like that, and so on. But it doesn't say, and each witness has to be questioned separately, apart from the other witness, okay, to make sure, you know, that they're not
collaborating.
They don't have sequestration of witnesses? They did not have sequestration of
They did have, right, they did.
They
One
did
from another
them.
When they're being questioned, right? And then they come in. And then afterwards the judges begin again to question, you see, you know, and to, you know, to judge pros, cons, and so on and so forth. Now, it doesn't say that people were not allowed to come in and be bystanders. Nowhere does it indicate that.
So when they were interrogated,
so it is possible, you know, that if they hear that, let's say that Yankel is being hailed before the court and being accused of murder, that the, you know, the rumor will spread throughout the town. Did you hear Yankel is being accused of murder, and so on? So people actually want to find out what's going on.
Okay,
you know?
But if people were present, the public was present at the interrogation of Group B, surely to determine whether or not Group B was lying or not, the judges would say to Group B, well, who else was there? Wouldn't that be one of the questions? In which case, if that was already stated in the public, then Group C would have been declared to be present also, or Group D. If they said there were 600 people at Aaron's party, and these were two of them, obviously they don't have to list everyone, but surely Group C would know, well, I was at Aaron's party, I better not say that.
It's a very difficult business for me to answer at this point, because in reality, you know, this we're working on the basis of the Mishnah. We're not working now in an actual court of law where we could actually see how it's happening in front of our eyes.
True. That's the problem.
See, that's the problem.
That is a problem.
Yeah.
And there's not, all we can do is infer from the Mishnah other corollary sources.
Well, I mean, and how the Gemara understands it, but as we can see, even after the Gemara understands it one way, along can come later authorities and try to understand it in a different way altogether.
I guess what I mean is with somebody, let's say, I hate to use this, but let's use Josephus as an example. Is there any contemporary Jewish historian, if you will, that wrote on the that watched a hearing or trial?
Well, Josephus gives testimony concerning different things, but not necessarily how the Sanhedrin operated, you know. Not necessarily. He was more interested in history and in customs and things like that. But nevertheless, I mean, he is still an interesting source of information as to what happened in the last days of the Second Beis Hamikdash and the war against the Romans.
About how the operation of Sanhedrin, no one described the
it's all, I mean, in the Mishnah and how the oral traditions, you know, that clustered about it, and as people tried to analyze, you know, the later authorities that came along tried to analyze.
Yes,
we know. I mean, obviously, I mean, he was trying to curry favor with the Romans. But nevertheless, a good deal of the things that he writes about, he was not necessarily trying to curry favor with the Romans. I mean, he's not, you know, giving the history of the rebellion against Rome from the point of view that, you know, the Jews never should have gotten started in the whole mess and so on. I mean, he does say that, you know, obviously. But nevertheless, in the Antiquities, which is a work that precedes the Jewish War, there he tries to give an idea, you know, what the Bible was like, and, you know, various institutions of Jewish life and so on, the customs and so on, so that this is a rather valuable work, simply to paint a broader picture of a period that otherwise we might have forgotten all about. You mean against Apion? Yeah, all right. The Against Apion was a little work that he wrote in which he was the ADL of his time. He takes the various anti-Semitic accusations that had been made by Greek and Egyptian writers, and he shows the falsity of these claims and how noble the Jewish people were. And as I said, you know, that's also related to his Antiquities, where he wanted to show the nobility of the Jewish people. After all, he himself was a Kohen, he was a general at first, and the governor of the Galil, you know, in the time of the war against the Romans, until, you know, he either he sold out to the Romans or whatever it may be.
Yeah. It's interesting now that each set of witnesses knew what the other set of witnesses had said.
Yeah.
Knowing, like, we have the grand jury system, even, and that's what puzzles me, you could have three sets of witnesses who had offered to appear.
Yeah.
And the first one happened to be the second one second set. Three sets of people offered to be witnesses. Mm-hmm. But here, are they saying that the second set of witnesses knew what the first set of witnesses said?
Obviously, the testimony must have been heard.
And then, what's the difference? And then the third set knew publicly. That didn't sound
or not sure, because
take it this way.
It was sequestered. No. No. They may not have known. I mean, no. You know, the way, actually, I remember being in the Old Bailey, all right? And I remember watching this trial. And if a witness is sequestered, then they keep them not away not only from the previous witnesses, but everybody in the public that heard the previous witness. So it could be that the second group came in, and that would add to their veracity and say, well, you know, we can testify that Shmuel and David were with us
right.
that day.
We don't even know what Shmuel
know
and
what
David testified, but that's not important, because they were with us at the time when they claimed that they saw what happened over there. Yeah.
And you know, what I was thinking is that the way they may have been able to discern the truth is somewhat like the when they try to examine people who create a false marriage for purposes of immigration. They may have taken each set and asked them 100 detailed questions. Where did it take place? Describe the tree. What were the color of the leaves of the tree? And then little by little try to piece together who was actually there and who was not, because that's the only issue before the court, if you will.
Yeah. All right, we have time to...
5 minutes.
Yes, we have a couple of more minutes before. Okay. Mm-hmm. So now, again, the Gemara wants to know, where is a biblical source written? In Noah Hanimit, right? Where do we find this alluded to in the Torah? So Omer Rav Abba d'Omakro, Rav Abba said, because we have a pasuk which says, V'hine eid sheker ho'eid, right? Sheker ona. This witness is a false witness, and he has testified falsely. Which means what? Which means atesh shetik shoker gufo shel edus. This is to tell us that the gufo shel edus, in other words, as I explained to you before from Rashi, this means that the witnesses themselves are proven to be sheker, that they're proven to be false. Okay? The Bei Rabbi Shmuel Tana, the school of Rabbi Yishmael, they taught it from a different pasuk, and it's La'anos Bosora, where also that, you know, these witnesses have come in order to testify perversely concerning him, right? Ad she'tisora gufo shel edus, until we prove, in other words, that these guys are really perverting with their testimony, you know, their testimony is perverse. All right. It's only, you know, that each one has their own tradition as to what would be the source. But obviously, the source is clear, you know, that if these people are false witnesses, then in that particular case, then what should be the punishment? The punishment, as we say, is kasher zomim lasos liyochid, right? Omar Rava, Rava said, bo shnayim, let's say that two witnesses come, v'yomru b'mizrach biro harak pleni es hanefesh, all right? And they give the following testimony. They say that in the eastern part of the biro, question is only, what is biro? So one interpretation of biro is the one that Rashi brings. Biro, he says, is Traklin Godol. In other words, a great big palace. Okay? That here was a great big palace where, you know, the witnesses were present, and they say that, hey, in the eastern part of that biro, by the way, it's another translation. After all, what do we say about Shushan HaBira? In Shushan HaBira, we take it in the sense, you know, like the capital city. So maybe it means, you know, like a great big city. By the way, in the Gemara, there are more translations. I mean, you know, it depends on how you use it. Of course, in modern Hebrew, the word biro also has a new meaning, but that has nothing to do with the situation, namely beer. But this has nothing to do with it. Okay. Good evening. How are you? I'm glad you came. Yes. So, at any rate, two witnesses come and they say, look, we saw that in the eastern part of the Bira, whichever way you want to take it, so so-and-so murdered so-and-so, right? Then along come another two witnesses, right? And they say, hey, you guys were with us, right, in the western part of this Bira. Okay? So, in that case, the question is, are we to say that this is Imanu HaYisem, I mean, right? And therefore, you could not have seen it? Or are we to say that maybe, yeah, Taki, you were with us, but the judges may determine that still they had the opportunity to see? You understand? So this is what the Gemara is asking right now. The temple itself had a bira. It's a large building in there, okay? A large building within the temple precinct. Citadel, yeah, if you like that, right. Right.
I read one time a bureau refers to something on the outside of the temple.
Well, it wasn't the Holy of Holies, if that's what you mean. That would be the Heichal, okay. But the bureau was also, they had all kinds of structures over there in the Temple Mount. So it was one of the important structures over there, okay? All right. So they say, all right, look, you were with us in the western part, right? So Chazinon, then we have to see either Kokayame Bemara Bira Mechazeh Chazal the Mizrach Bira, right? If we go to the western part of this Bira and we take a look and we see that you can see what's going on in the eastern part over there, then in that particular case we say Enelu Zomimin, they're not Zomimin.
Right, they're just
because was right. The Yim Lav, but if we go to the west and we see that the Taki cannot see what's over there in the east, then in that case, Hare Elu Zomimin. Then in that case, we have to say, then the second group, you know, that the first group who testified that they saw the murder taking place, that they were really false witnesses, because the second group said they were with us in the western part, and you can't see from over there what was going on.
So the Sanhedrin, the Dayanim, actually go and take
they
a
have
view.
To go
they
and take testimony, right, and
they
have to examine for
see.
Themselves and see, exactly. All right, it's time for us to stop at this particular point.
They must also do the same.
Okay.
All right.
So anyway, on this last statement, the Gemara asks the following question, says Peshitta. So isn't this obvious, it says. So he says, no, it's not so obvious, because Mahu the same. Maybe you might argue as follows. That maybe we should be concerned about some people have a much better, and let's say they're more farsighted than others, than the regular group of people. So we should then be concerned about that. So therefore, Kamash Malon, therefore we learn that this is not necessarily so. In other words, you don't go to see whether, you know, somebody can see better, but you go by the average. Can the average person see or not? Okay. So likewise, we have again something which is along the same lines over here. Hi, David. Where are you, David? David Hirschman. Legal questions over here. He comes here late. All right. Behomar Robin. Robin said, Bohu Shnayim. All right. Two witnesses come, right? Behomru. And they say, Besuro b'tzafro b'chad b'shabbato horak pleni is hanefesh, right? They testify against Pliny, whoever he may be, right? Let's say, whatever name you want to assign to him.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And they say, you know, he murdered someone in Sura in the morning, and it was Sunday morning, b'chad b'shabbato, okay? Safra means morning, right? And b'chad b'shabbato on the first day of the week, in other words, it was Sunday morning, and he murdered somebody in Sura. He committed a murder in Sura. Okay. Voshnaim, and then another group of two, in other words, a new set of witnesses, they come along, v'yomru, and they say, hey, b'fanyu b'chad b'shabbato, Sunday evening, imonu yisim in harda. You were together with us in the harda. So, what should we do? So the Gemara says, chazinun, we take a look and we see. Imitzafu l'fanyu matzi asa l'sur l'harda. If it is possible between the morning and the evening for a person to go from Surah to Nahardah, then in that the case, then you cannot say that these people were Zimmerman. In other words, it could be a very legitimate business, you know, that the Taka, they saw the event taking place in Surah in the morning, and in the evening they got to Nahardah, and it was perfectly okay. And was absolutely possible for the average person traveling, in order to get there at that time. Okay. So they're not Zevimim. So, again, the Gemara says, Pshita, shouldn't this be obvious? I mean, if you can figure out that obviously they were able to get from Surah to the Hardor within the course of the day between sunrise and sunset, so to speak, right? What's the problem? So he says, modern same. Maybe you'll say, now the Taka, they were, but what happened? Lichush legamlo parcha. Maybe they went on a flying camel. jet propelled camel. So in that case, then it's possible, that
they got there on time.
Yeah, and therefore, again, the same idea is that, you don't go by what is unusual. You go only by what is usual. Speaking about the flying camel, okay, I saw one comment which is based upon the Encyclopedia Britannica, believe it or not, where they have an article about camels, and it says that there are certain camels that they had in those days who could travel actually more than 50 miles a day because they didn't have to stop for food and drink.
Mm-hmm.
They could load up and just go straight. So it's an interesting side commentary, but the point is, that in any case, the Beis Din is not required to look for an unusual thing. You have to look about what happens in the ordinary case in order to determine whether these witnesses are reliable or whether these witnesses are zimun. V'yoma Rava. And now Rava comes along and he says something else. Okay, David, we'll wait for you to find a place. We are past the midway right now.
Wow.
Yeah. You missed some.
Kind of flying camel.
Oh, boy. Wow. Yeah. V'yoma Rava.
Wow.
Another V'yoma Rava. Right. Another statement of Rava concerning about these witnesses, whether they are to be considered Zomimim or not. Okay?
Yeah.
It says, Voshnaim, here comes a set of witnesses, V'yomer, and they say, Chad b'shabbato horak Pliny sanesh, that Pliny killed this person, it was on Sunday. Voshnaim, now along comes a second group of witnesses, V'yomer, and they say, hey, Imone Yisim b'chad b'shabbato. You guys, you were together with us on Sunday, right? Which would mean automatically that they should be considered as Zimmerman, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then they continue with their testimony, this new set of witnesses, and they say, Ela betrei b'shabbato, horak pleini es hanefesh. As a matter of fact, it says, when the murder was committed? Yeah, the guy who you are testifying against, Taked, did murder, but it wasn't on Sunday. It was instead on Monday. So in other words, obviously they were liars when it came to what? To testifying that they saw the murderer committed on Sunday. And on Sunday, according to the second group of witnesses, the accused was innocent because the action had not yet taken place. Okay, this is the situation now. Okay? So, the law old, and not only that, but I'll add one more thing, says Rabbi. Elatilu omru erev Shabbos, harag plenius hanefesh. Even if the witnesses said that, the murder was committed erev Shabbos, not on Sunday, but it was on Friday before, okay? In which case, what? In which case, actually, you would think, that the murderer, he had really committed the murder, right? According to the second group, we're talking about second group.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that do as far as the first group of witnesses, the one who are accused of being Adam Zomerman? You understand? This is what the problem is.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know what it says? It says, Neherogen. The Adam Zomimim are put to death. Why are they put to death? Why are they punished this way? So the Gemara says, Dibeidno, because at the very time, right, that they were giving testimony concerning this person, concerning the accused, whom they saw murder, right?
Mm.
So he was gabra ba'ala bakatolahu. He was not yet subject to what? To the death penalty. Why wasn't he subject to the death penalty? Well, obviously, if they say that the murder took place on Monday, we don't have that problem, because the deed actually took place afterwards. So we know that the other guys were a bunch of liars. They were Adam Zimmerman. All that they wanted at that time, was to accuse a guy wrongfully of death. But why, if it happened Erev Shabbos, this is the question.
Why did
when it had already, and they say that it happened on Sunday. The following Sunday, right? So why? So we have to come to the conclusion, as we'll see in a moment, that because the guy had not yet actually been sentenced to death. As long as the accused had not yet been
committed,
had not been sentenced to death by the Beis Din, then their testimony was still testimony which was being given falsely concerning the accused. Tricky.
I don't follow it.
Okay. The first part is easy to follow.
Yeah.
The fact, that they come in on Monday and they say, that is, they come in and they say, on Monday.
The murder was committed.
Right, the murder was committed. Okay? When the first group, the Zimmerman had said, that they saw the murder take place on Sunday, so obviously they were lying, according to the second group. Okay, so that we can understand.
The second group said it was
on Monday. But what if the second group comes and they say that actually the murder had already been committed Erev Shabbos?
Friday, yeah.
On Friday, right? So why do we still say that these are Adam Zomimim? So the answer is because the accused...